If you're looking for more conversations around local and national politics, then look no further than Inside Politics, the RNC in Charlotte. WFAE's new podcast covering the RNC and the 2020 presidential race through the lens of Charlotte. Listen to Inside Politics, the RNC in Charlotte on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, and WFAE.org/insidepolitics. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Now that the race for the Democratic presidential nomination has pretty much been decided, the Veep Stakes is now underway. The process of picking a running mate for presumed nominee Joe Biden, who has pledged to have a woman share the ticket with him. The significance of the vice presidency has been much debated through America's history. John Nance Garner, one of three vice presidents under Franklin Roosevelt, famously said it wasn't worth a warm bucket of spit. At least that's the radio-friendly version of this quote. What's more, the job hasn't always been a springboard to the Oval Office. Only 14 presidents were previously vice president. Some got there through the ballot box, others through tragedy.
As the nation is plunged into mourning by President Roosevelt's death, Harry S. Truman becomes president.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time. 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Some 38 minutes ago. Vice President Lyndon Johnson has left the hospital.
In all, eight presidents had to take over unexpectedly from their predecessors. Many went on to have a profound impact on the nation, indeed the world, underlining the importance of who fills out a presidential ticket. On this Politics Monday, we look at the men author Jared Cohen calls accidental presidents, eight men who changed America. Jared Cohen joined us in April 2019 when Accidental Presidents was published.
Thank you for coming on the program. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
In reality, weren't there actually nine?
So I get asked this question a lot. Why didn't I include Nixon to Ford? Mm-hmm. And my joking answer is I ran out of time and I didn't want to have to do an additional chapter. But the real reason is, if you look at the eight times in history a president has died in office, it's that abrupt and unexpected transfer of power that dominates the trend, where the transition is dominated by mourning and no anticipation. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the case of Nixon, you didn't have a situation where the country was in mourning. It wasn't Gerald Ford, when he ascended to the presidency, wasn't, you know, working against the sort of heels of tragedy. People had time, because of the Watergate investigations, to imagine a situation where Ford was president. So it to me, it's a different kind of transition that doesn't rob the country of their president, and it's a self-inflicted wound when a president has to resign.
You have a keen interest in international affairs. You've worked at the State Department under both Condoleezza Rice and Hillary Clinton when they were secretaries of state, and you are a technologist and president of a technology incubator. Why your interest in accidental presidents? This seems out of your interest scope.
So it's funny, when I told people that I have a new book out, this is my fourth, the first question they said is, oh, is it a book about cyber war or is it a book about foreign policy? And I said, no, it's a book about eight dead presidents. And the honest truth is, this is the book I've always wanted to write. My parents, when I was 8 years old, bought me a children's book called The Buck Stops Here. Mm-hmm. And it was one of those rhyming books about presidents, you know, each page devoted to a different president. And they wanted to turn me into a precocious child. What they didn't realize is they had to have eight separate conversations with me about death, four conversations with me about assassination. And these were such heavy topics for an eight-year-old, not to mention the picture of Lincoln keeling over and McKinley keeling over and Kennedy keeling over. It was not the conversation they wanted to have with me. Now, the obsession sustained my entire life, and I became a collector of presidential memorabilia. And when my wife was pregnant with our eldest daughter, I needed a nesting activity. And I decided, you know, since I needed a nesting activity, I was going to finally buckle down and write this book, because I'd spent my entire life reading biographies on the eight men who were never supposed to be president.
Hmm. And I know at one point, I told you before we started this conversation that we share a common, at least as a young person, I shared a common interest with you as a young person, and that I was fascinated with both the Kennedy and the Lincoln assassinations and read everything I could get my hands on about those two assassinations. But you took it way, way further than I did. I don't even know what you call it, but you had a whole room in your house set aside to an SVU investigation of the assassination. Correct?
It is true that when Oliver Stone's movie about the JFK assassination came out, I decided that I was going to solve the Kennedy assassination, and I built a Kennedy room in my house, which meant that I took an existing room and redecorated it, and much to the dismay of my parents, punched a bunch of holes in the walls and had yarn, you know, spanning the walls, connecting different photos and so forth. But what I'll say about presidents, which is interesting, and it explains how somebody like me ends up writing a book like The Accidental Presidents. When you're a young kid, you view geopolitics and politics and domestic politics, you basically view the world through these symbolic figures that are easy for you to understand. Mm-hmm. You know, it's easy for a 2-year-old and a 3-year-old and a 4-year-old to understand what it, you know, they know they live in a country called America, and they know what it means for somebody to be in charge. So they can get their head around the idea of a president. And so it's, you know, these are early figures that a child is able to get excited about and get curious about. But I find that adults are equally fascinated by presidents. And what I wanted to do with this book was combine three passions of mine: history, politics, and just general musings about what makes good leaders.
I promise you we're going to talk about your book and the people in the book, but I have to bring this up too, because I read that you have something very few people in the world have, and that is you have acquired locks of President Lincoln's hair and the hair of William Henry Harrison. How on earth did you accomplish that, and where do you keep those artifacts?
So what I would say is the one promise in my life that I've gone back on is I pledged to my family that I would never talk about my hair collection because it's dreadfully embarrassing to them. But what I will tell you, when I describe the locks of presidential hair that I have, I promise you that it's weird until you see it. Mm-hmm. And then once you see it, it's really amazing. So I have a lock of...
I don't think it's weird. I just think it's interesting. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I have a lock of Abraham Lincoln's hair from the night of his assassination, a lock of William Henry Harrison's hair, Ronald Reagan, Dwight Eisenhower, John Adams, and, of course, George Washington. And historically, people didn't ask the president for an autograph. There's a lot of letters written by average citizens to presidents asking for a lock of their hair. So the president would snip a lock of their hair, seal it with wax to a piece of paper, and mail it back as a free frank to the sort of the 1800s equivalent of an autograph seeker. And what's interesting is they would get both the autograph and the hair.
Wow. And so you've collected these over time because they're available on the open market from other collectors. Is that how you did it?
It's a small ecosystem of hair people,
I had no idea.
All kind of know each other.
Wow, I had no idea. That's it. Now, see, we've opened up a whole new world for people out there who want to do this with you. The Vice President of the United States is often chosen for, you write about this, for political expediency. Until Dick Cheney and Joe Biden, a lot of the presidents kept their vice presidents at arm's length and maybe farther away than that. A lot of presidents didn't like their vice president. Some of them didn't know him. Of the accidental presidents that you write about, how many fall into that category?
So this is one of the things that I found extraordinary in researching this book, is of the 8 accidental presidents, not a single one of them was integrated into the administration, and not a single one of them was liked by their predecessor. So these were men who were thrown on the ticket as political marriages of convenience to win a state or appease a constituency, or in some cases, like Teddy Roosevelt, to punish somebody who New York party bosses didn't like. So these were not men that anybody imagined as president or that anybody wanted as president. And, you know, in a lot of these cases, the vice president ascends to the presidency at a critical moment in history, right? So Reconstruction, a world war, the height of the Cold War. So a president who the people had voted into office ends up dying, and somebody they never imagined, never wanted, and who had no idea what was going on ends up thrust to the pinnacle of power. So if you look at this from a business perspective, imagine having as your successor in a major business, and you could argue that the business of government is the largest business in the world. Imagine having an anointed successor who has no idea what's going on in the business, has no relationship with the business's leadership, isn't read into anything significant, and then one day has to run the business at one of the most important parts in its trajectory.
We're going to talk a lot about this because this flies in the face of what we hold dear in our hearts as Americans, and that is that the founding fathers are likened unto God because they didn't make any mistakes. Well, they did, and this is one of them. In your foreword, you say that the men whose stories you tell in your book ascended to the presidency without the Constitution having specified an order of succession. The founders, you say, didn't think of everything. But now wait. If you read Article 2, Section 1, Paragraph 6, the Constitution specifies that the vice president should assume the office in the event of the death, resignation, or inability of the president to perform his duty. So why do you say that these men came to office without the Constitution's help?
So the Constitution is clear that the vice president of the United States ends up discharging the duties of president upon a vacancy, but the Constitution doesn't say that the vice president becomes president. And this is one of the big sort of gaping holes left by the founding fathers. So when John Tyler of Virginia is vice president and finds out that William Henry Harrison has died just 30 days after taking the oath of office, he rushes back from Virginia to the nation's capital because he knows that a fight is going to ensue. The cabinet that he inherits and Congress both reject the notion that John Tyler is president. They accept that he discharges the duties, but they view him as a vice president acting as president or just an acting president. John Tyler thinks otherwise, and he spends his first months after Harrison's death, you know, trying to win those battles. And he never really wins them because for the rest of his presidency, he returns letters unopened that address him as vice president. He's called his accidency. He's called the great usurper. But he does set a precedent, and he sets a precedent that's followed for seven future presidents. So if you look at, you know, what's extraordinary is as recently as 1963, when JFK is assassinated, LBJ becomes president based on the precedent set by John Tyler in 1841. That precedent is not formalized until the 25th Amendment, which is ratified in 1967.
So let's be clear about this, because you write extensively about this in the book. When John Tyler ascends to the presidency, they dispatch, after President, it's Harrison, right?
Yes.
After he dies, two members of the cabinet or two members of the staff ride to Virginia. It's an arduous journey because he's way out God knows where in Virginia, and they have to cross rivers and take different modes of transportation to get to him. He's in Virginia because the vice president doesn't do anything. And he thought, well, okay, I'm not the president. I'm the vice president. I'm going to go home. But he knew this was going on. He knew Harrison was sick, correct?
That's correct. So Harrison delivers the longest inaugural address in history. It's over an hour and 40 minutes long in the freezing cold. John Tyler attends the inauguration and then basically skips out of town to his home in Virginia, where he plans to spend the next 4 years because he knows his office is completely irrelevant. So fortunately for John Tyler, a friend of his, a Virginia sort of states' rightist loyalist of his, had heard that Harrison was sick and tipped him off about a week before he found out the news that Harrison had died. So Tyler had the time to think through this question of whether he was going to be president or acting president. And then he had lots of time on the long journey from Virginia back to the nation's capital. But what I found frustrating about this particular moment in history is it should not have been left so unclear for that long. So what's interesting is James Madison, who was essentially the principal drafter of the Constitution, nearly dies in office when he's president. He's on his deathbed with a very serious case of typhoid, and they begin succession proceedings in the Senate to talk about what this means for Vice President Gary. Dolly Madison catches wind of this and writes a letter exaggerating her husband's recovery, which ends up being true, but then they stop the proceedings. After Madison recovers, nobody bothers to ask one of the architects of the Constitution what this means and to clarify it. And same when Andrew Jackson is shot at point blank by an assailant who thinks he's the King of England.
Let me stop you there for a second. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more with Jared Cohen. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
It's Politics Monday on Charlotte Talks here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Vice presidents who suddenly found themselves in the presidency is the topic with Jared Cohen, author of Accidental Presidents, Eight Men Who Changed America, which was published in April 2019. These are the VPs who came to power through the death of their predecessor. Most of them weren't well-known or well-liked, and sometimes their political persuasion was entirely different than their predecessors.
In the case of John Tyler, we were just talking about, who came to power after William Henry Harrison died, you were just talking about Dolly Madison and James Madison, some of the framers of the Constitution. There were no framers of the Constitution alive at the time of William Henry Harrison's death to consult about what they meant, what their intent was with regard to whether the president who comes to office because the other president has died should be the president, or an acting president carrying out the presidency duties without the title. They couldn't consult anybody on that, correct?
That's correct. James Madison had died 4 years before, and you know, I found myself pulling my hair out reading about this history, because what I can't fathom is after Andrew Jackson is nearly assassinated, shot at point blank by a man who thinks he's the king of England, nobody thinks that, okay, this can really happen. Maybe we should clarify the language in the Constitution. When it almost happens to James Madison himself, one of the architects of the Constitution, he doesn't try to clarify it. So what were they doing? What were they thinking when these things happened? I mean, what's clear is, these close calls didn't trigger any conversation about the Constitution and presidential succession. So we missed an opportunity. And, as flawed as John Tyler was, I mean, this is a man who, ended up being a traitor to the Union and elected to the Confederate House of Representatives, kicked out of his own party, and the first impeachment proceedings were proposed against him. His one saving grace and why he gets a D- instead of an F is he does set this important precedent that mitigates the risks associated with the vulnerability in presidential succession.
Let's talk about how he did that, because as you say, when they dispatched these people to Virginia to come and tell him that the president was dead and that he should come to Washington and assume the duties of the president, the cabinet was in no mood to name him President Tyler. He was vice president carrying out the duties of the dead president. How did he manage to convince them otherwise? Because it wasn't just them, the cabinet, it was the Senate and the House. They didn't want him to be president either.
That's correct. And he basically cobbles together a coalition of very loud and powerful voices. And what's interesting is he manipulates Henry Clay. Henry Clay, one of the great secondary figures in American history to the president of the United States, thinks that John Tyler is an ally. But John Tyler is not really a Whig. He's much more of a Democrat. And Henry Clay is surprised when John Tyler ends up, opposing most of the Whig agenda. So then Henry Clay leads the charge to formally excommunicate and kick John Tyler out of his party. John Tyler finds himself a president without a party, desperate to win election in his own right in 1844, and decides that the best path to do this is to covertly annex Texas. It's a little bit erratic.
I'd say. John Tyler came to office after Harrison's death, and that brought into focus another weakness in our system at the time, and possibly to this day, although the way the vice president was chosen in those days was very different from how it's done today. Tyler evidently barely knew Harrison, and from what he did know, didn't like him much. Was that the same in both directions?
That was the same in both directions. And by the way, that's consistent with just about every president and vice president relationship in history, and certainly the case with the eight accidental presidents.
Is that because as the vice president, you're a heartbeat away and therefore breathing down the neck of the president, and they don't really want to think about you very much? Or is there something else at play there?
Well, if you think about why vice presidents are typically chosen, which is to win a state, what it means is the person at the top of the ticket is unpopular in that state. Which means that the person they're putting on the ticket who has popularity where they're weak probably supports a set of things that they disagree with. So they're strange bedfellows to begin with. But in that electoral moment, nobody's thinking about policy. Nobody's imagining the vice president as president. And then they're typically out of the loop. When I interviewed Henry Kissinger for the book, I asked him this question in the context of Harry Truman, because everyone knew FDR was a dying man when Truman was thrown on the ticket. So why was Truman not more integrated into the administration? And Kissinger's view is that until recently, for the president of the United States to have the vice president lingering around was an unsettling feeling, because mm-hmm. this is the person who would most rejoice if your heart stopped beating.
Yeah, now, if I remember my American history from grade school, high school, the way we used to choose vice presidents is very different. Like John Adams, the first vice president to George Washington, was chosen because he came in second in the number of votes. And so the second vote getter got to be the second highest vote getter got to be the vice president, which automatically, in some cases, put a person of a different party, certainly a different political persuasion than you, in the office next door. And they didn't have any duties whatsoever. And the same is true with John Tyler. Was he chosen because he was not? Had they changed that system, I guess is the question, by the time John Tyler became the vice president?
Yeah, so they changed that system by the time Tyler became vice president. The way the vice president has been selected has gone through three stages, and I allude to this in the book. Initially, the framers of the Constitution didn't want a vice president. What they imagined was the vice president as an electoral mechanism. So the person who got the second largest number of votes in the presidential election became the VP. That was changed with the 12th Amendment. And then you enter phase two. Phase two was that the convention would pick the vice president and the presidential nominee would have nothing to do with that choice. And in fact, it would be seen as taboo for them to have anything to do with that choice. And by the way, that phase lasts all the way through until the 1960 election. In the 1960 election, you see an inflection point where all of a sudden the nominee of the party is making the choice on their own, based on the needs of a campaign, and that's where we've been ever since.
So it's not constitutionally prescribed because the founders didn't want a vice president, really? Why do we have one at all then?
They didn't see a need for a vice president, but what they saw a need for was an electoral mechanism mm-hmm. where what do you do with the person who gets the second largest number of votes? They didn't really think of the vice president as a successor, which is why the language around presidential succession in the Constitution is so vague. What's interesting is until the 25th Amendment in 1967, there's no provision to replace the vice president of the United States, and yet six of the eight accidental presidents themselves nearly die in office.
Hmm. As we've said several times, the politics of John Tyler and William Henry Harrison was very different. And Harrison obviously put loyalists in his cabinet who thought similarly to him. And they didn't like, didn't trust, disagreed with John Tyler when he came to power. How often has that been the case when a vice president comes to power unexpectedly, that he faces a cabinet, a structure that is not in line with his thinking?
More often than not, and how they handle it depends on whether they're successful or fail. So Millard Fillmore, who ascends to the presidency in 1850 when Zachary Taylor dies in office, he ascends to the presidency at arguably the most polarized moment in American history. You know, the debate over slavery is at its height. They're trying to figure out what to do with all the land acquired based on the victory in a war against Mexico. And so Taylor dies in office, and Millard Fillmore takes the oath of office, and the first thing that Fillmore does is he sacks the entire cabinet. So as we look at musical chairs in the cabinet today, and as we look at vacancies in the cabinet, Millard Fillmore got rid of everybody and then couldn't replace them. So he ends up with nobody in charge of his cabinet for months.
Even then, it was customary when a new president came in, evidently, for the cabinet to offer their letters of resignation, but they were never accepted. He accepted them, much to their surprise, correct?
Yeah, and then he had the audacity to ask them to stay on for 3 weeks to help with the transition, and just to be jerks, they said we'll stay on for less than a week.
When Lyndon Johnson became president after the assassination of John Kennedy, he kept the cabinet intact, and he kept the former president's brother Robert Kennedy as Attorney General. Those two men were like oil and water; they did not like each other. Did Johnson decide to keep Kennedy loyalist in his midst for the remainder of that first term out of respect or out of political expediency?
Johnson didn't do things out of respect. He was the ultimate political animal and tactician. What Lyndon Johnson encountered is something that any accidental president ascending on the heels of somebody who's beloved has to deal with, which is navigating the legacy of their predecessor and not being seen as running too fast away. And so Johnson was adamant about bringing Camelot along with him, even though he had absolutely no there was nothing similar about Lyndon Johnson to the Kennedys. And so he begged these men to stay so that the transition was smooth. And what people don't realize about Lyndon Johnson is, had Kennedy not been assassinated, Johnson almost certainly would have had to resign as vice president. He was engulfed in a massive corruption scandal involving one of his Senate aides. And what I found in writing Accidental Presidents and doing interviews for the book is that both CBS and Time Life had the goods on Lyndon Johnson. They were prepared to go public with the story the following week. And then this horrific tragedy plays out on television, and both news outlets make a deliberate decision to put it back in the box, because you can't have a president die, a president ascend, and then have that president, you know, engulfed in scandal at the height of the Cold War.
Wow. So if the networks knew that, did the cabinet know it?
I'm not. I have no evidence that the cabinet knew it, but I do suspect that, in particular, RFK had toyed with the idea of tossing LBJ off the ticket, scandal or no scandal, because LBJ was seen as the only way that JFK could win Texas. But when they take that trip to Texas, one of the things that they realize is LBJ is not as helpful as they anticipated.
LBJ's presidency was derailed by Vietnam, and Vietnam was largely the work of Robert McNamara, who was an elite Ivy League appointee of John Kennedy to be Secretary of Defense. Had he replaced Robert McNamara with somebody else, had he not been loyal to Kennedy or want to maintain some sort of appearance of continuity, would he have better served himself?
So I write about two criticisms related to Vietnam in the book, one of LBJ and one of JFK. With LBJ, he was determined to be a great domestic president, and he knew how to get things done domestically, but he didn't exhibit the same level of courage on foreign policy that he did on civil rights. And so my view is he should have gotten rid of Kennedy's national security team, but he didn't have the confidence to do it, because these elite Harvard intellectuals, he called them the Harvards, he wrestled with hatred of them and admiration for them. So he would famously, you know, go to restaurants and copy McNamara's orders and, you know, habits at the dinner table. So he sort of emulated and hated them. But what Johnson was terrified of was things falling apart on his watch. So when he looked at civil rights falling apart on his watch, he knew how to get something done, and he knew what to do about it. When he saw Vietnam falling apart on his watch, you know, he didn't know what to do about it. So he just listened to these men who seemed to know more than him about foreign policy. And it's painful and agonizing to listen to the tapes where Lyndon Johnson knows this is a terrible idea, and he continues going in this direction. With Kennedy, you know, the guardians of Kennedy's reputation, Arthur Schlesinger and others, have absolved Kennedy of responsibility for Vietnam. I think Kennedy was as capable of going down the same slippery slope that LBJ went down.
Jared Cohen is our guest. He's the author of Accidental Presidents, Eight Men Who Changed America. It's about eight of the nine vice presidents who have come to power upon the either death, in the book, the death of the previous president, but the ninth person was Gerald Ford, who came into power when, obviously, Richard Nixon resigned. How many of these vice presidents who came to power chose to carry on the policies of their predecessor, at least for the remainder of that term before they themselves, and only four were reelected, but before they themselves were reelected, how many of them decided to do it that way? How many of them took a different direction from their predecessor?
So only two of them continued the administration in a way that resembled their predecessor. So Calvin Coolidge inherits the presidency after Warren Harding dies in office. And this is the era of the president being hands-off. The economy is completely roaring. You know, Americans are intoxicated by Eskimo pies and consumer products, and they don't care if the president is Warren Harding, Calvin Coolidge, or Herbert Hoover, as long as the economy continues to boom. What's interesting about Harding is he's the most scandalous president in history, and he dies enormously popular, but the scandals break just 3 months into Calvin Coolidge's presidency, and less than a year on the horizon, you have the 1924 presidential election. So Calvin Coolidge evaluates himself and determines that he already has a reputation for being a non-entity, so he doubles down on that and cultivates this image of Silent Cal, a man so boring and insignificant that he couldn't possibly have had anything to do with the Harding scandals. The one that's remarkable to me is Harry Truman, because Harry Truman gets thrown on the ticket in 1944 when everybody knows FDR is a dying man because the party bosses can't fathom the idea of Henry Wallace, a Soviet sympathizer, being president of the United States. Mm-hmm. And during Truman's 82 days as president, he doesn't get a single as vice president, he doesn't get a single intelligence briefing, doesn't meet a single foreign leader, isn't read into Yalta, isn't briefed on the Manhattan Project. And when FDR dies on April 12, 1945, Harry Truman begins the ramp-up process. He's a provincial aw-shucks politician who has nothing in common with elite intellectuals like Dean Acheson and George Marshall, and yet he has to make some of the most important decisions in just his first 4 months as president. But Truman does what LBJ fails to do, which is he finds the right balance between listening to those advisors and trusting his own judgment.
Is it true that we talk about how removed from FDR and his policies and his cabinet and his decision-making process that Harry Truman was when he came to office, never gotten an intelligence briefing in the entire time he was vice president? Is it true he's the man who ended World War II by dropping the atom bomb on Japan twice, that he did not even know when he was vice president that there was a Manhattan Project and what it was up to?
That's correct. Truman gets briefed on the Manhattan Project 30 minutes after taking the oath of office. And by the way, it doesn't happen in just one briefing. So Secretary of War Stimson briefs him in vague terms on the Manhattan Project, but Truman comes away from that first briefing not really clear what Stimson is talking about. So it takes three briefings for Truman to really understand that there's this destructive weapon the world has never seen before. And he's wrestling with this question of, do I have to move a million men from the European theater to the Asian Pacific theater, or do I just try to end this once and for all with this destructive weapon, which, by the way, we still don't know if it works. So the first successful test happens while Truman is at Potsdam meeting with Churchill and Stalin. So news comes just in time.
Wow. The founding fathers were inventing something completely new. They couldn't possibly have anticipated every contingency. They could not have possibly foreseen that the office of the President of the United States would become the most powerful political position in the world. But we have the benefit from hindsight. We have the knowledge. And when we come back, I want to talk about why we haven't changed the way we do this with vice presidents. We're talking to Jared Cohen, who is the author of Accidental Presidents, 8 Men Who Changed America. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Charlotte Talks just marked its 22nd year on the air on WFAE. When the show launched, Charlotte was wrestling with growth, the role of race in public schools, transportation. There were big bank mergers, and the country was headed toward a presidential impeachment. The more things change, huh? What hasn't changed is the importance of listeners' financial support. Click the donate button at WFAE.org or call 704-549-9000. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're spending this Politics Monday looking at vice presidents, specifically those who have been thrust into the presidency over the course of American history. It's a subject that Jared Cohen covered in his April 2019 book, Accidental Presidents, 8 Men Who Changed America.
The founding fathers could not have anticipated any of what's become of America or the United States and how important the president has become in the world, not just in this country. But we have the benefit of hindsight. We have the knowledge. And if we don't, your book will fill us in on the men who became unintendedly president. Given that, why do voters, why do journalists, why do political parties, why do potential presidents seem to give short shrift to those who will fill the role of vice president or see that person more as a political tool as opposed to somebody who could run the country?
So I find this reality endlessly frustrating, because despite the fact that you had 8 presidents die in office and you've had 19 close calls where the president almost died in office, we seem to have learned absolutely nothing from history. And it's already bad enough that we winged presidential succession for most of the history of the republic. And it's bad enough that throughout most of the Cold War, we still didn't get this right when the threat of nuclear weapons was real. But what I find more remarkable is we're in the longest period of time without a president dying in office. We have the oldest president in the history of the United States. And on the Democratic side, you have front runners who are in their 70s.
Right.
And yet we're still talking about the vice president as a political gimmick.
And you've said that over our history, disastrous choices have been made, or have been few, rather, while most are unremarkable by design. Have we been lucky?
You know, we've been largely lucky in the sense that of the eight, only one was an absolute catastrophe. But the one that was an absolute catastrophe changed our country's history in ways that we're still grappling with and dealing with today. So it's hard to look at this and say we've been lucky.
You're talking about Andrew Johnson?
I'm talking about Andrew Johnson. Mm-hmm. We were supposed to get Abraham Lincoln's vision of Reconstruction. Instead, the bullet of John Wilkes Booth gave us Andrew Johnson. And as I write about in the book, Johnson was the last president to own slaves. He was born a racist. He died a racist. And there's this incredible story that I write about where he's completely inebriated while delivering the vice presidential oath of office.
I got to tell you, that is a remarkable story in your book. My jaw dropped, as did people watching the swearing-in ceremony. Talk about that.
Well, it was supposed to last a minute, and it was a 17-minute drunken diatribe that ended with him slobbering all over the Bible, forgetting the Secretary of War's name, embarrassing himself and the entire joint session of Congress. Abraham Lincoln has his head buried in his hands in embarrassment, and when this drunken display is done, he walks side by side with Andrew Johnson, and to ease the sort of the awkwardness, he points out Frederick Douglass, who's at the time the most famous ex-slave in the country. And Douglass writes about this moment in his autobiography and describes how he looked into Andrew Johnson's eyes and they were glazed over and they looked at him with such hatred and animosity that he came to two conclusions. One, the country was lucky this man wasn't president. And two, that man is no friend of my race. Now, Douglass didn't realize Johnson was drunk, but certainly came to the right conclusion. Andrew Johnson ends up giving amnesty to all the Confederate leadership, delegating civil rights to the states, which paves the way for what are called the Black Codes, and then creates space for the Jim Crow laws that gave us segregation. So the accidental president in this case drastically changes the course of our history. And to say that we got lucky is to reject the notion that we're still feeling the repercussions of segregation today.
So why did Lincoln choose him? Because he replaced his vice president from the first term with Andrew Johnson.
So remember, back then, the candidate didn't select the vice president. But Lincoln, very cleverly, is part of a massive intrigue to replace the incumbent vice president, Hannibal Hamlin, with Andrew Johnson. So when I set out to write Accidental Presidents, I wanted to vindicate Lincoln's participation in this intrigue and figure out how could he be so reckless. What I realized in writing this is that there's a missing chapter of history. Andrew Johnson was one of the poorest men ever to rise to the presidency, and he owed everything to the Union and his mobility, and he hated the Southern aristocracy. So at the time of 1864, Lincoln needed a war Democrat from a border state in order to even have a chance of winning the election. Mm-hmm. Andrew Johnson was one of the most revered men in the North because he had been the only Southern senator to stay loyal to the Union. And he wanted to unite the Union more than he cared about his principles and his racist sentiments. And so for Johnson, the best way to unite the Union was to break the Confederacy. So pragmatism trumped belief. Wow. And his rhetoric at the time was more forward-leaning on civil rights and punishment of traitors than even Lincoln. So when Lincoln dies, Jefferson Davis essentially says the South is in real trouble.
Yeah, Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy, believed that Lincoln had power over Northerners, but was without personal malignity toward the people of the South, to use his words, while Andrew Johnson, he said, had no power over the Northern people, but was the, quote, embodiment of malignity toward the Southern people, perhaps the more so because he had betrayed and deserted them in their hour of need. Those are pretty strong words.
And that is, in fact, what the Southern reaction was to Andrew Johnson. And by the way, in the North, the radical Republicans, this is why they initially loved Andrew Johnson. But 6 weeks after he becomes president, the Civil War is over. And for Johnson, it's then all about putting the Union back together. At which point his raison d'etre for advocating civil rights and punishment of traitors ends up disappearing, and it's all about amnesty and efficiency.
Hmm. Part of this, I guess, could be laid at the feet of the blame for this could be laid at the feet of Abraham Lincoln. I'm sure that he didn't intend to die at Ford's Theater, but he had no blueprint available. Had he talked about it? He didn't write anything down about how he wanted to see the Union cobbled back together. He talked about it in his second inaugural address to bind up the nation's wounds, but he had no plan.
And this is both true of Abraham Lincoln and of FDR. Both men were presiding over wars at the time of their reelection, neither of which had been won yet. And yet neither of them forecasted or foreshadowed or documented what they wanted the post-war order to look like. So in the case of the Civil War, the blank piece of paper left by Abraham Lincoln gave Andrew Johnson the maneuvering room to chart his own course on this. In the case of Harry Truman, it was a little bit different because the men who he inherited around FDR, they needed Truman to be successful because the fate of the world required it.
We haven't really changed anything, but in the last three vice presidents, Dick Cheney under George W. Bush, Joe Biden under Barack Obama, and now Mike Pence under President Trump, have been given more things to do, more power. Joe Biden had lunch every week with the president, and they talked about things, and he was given tasks. And all three of them evidently have their own security staff apparatus and regular intelligence briefings and have their foreign policy agendas sanctioned by the president. None of that is required by law. Are we seeing a shift in the way that presidents use and treat the vice president?
We've certainly seen a normative shift. So it's true that Dick Cheney, Joe Biden, and Mike Pence are all fully integrated into the administration. They're read in. They're part of the mix. They have varying degrees of influence on foreign and domestic policy. But you know, should the unthinkable happen, they'll know what's going on. And you may disagree with their politics, but they're capable of leading the country. The problem is, what happens one day if we get a president who doesn't want their vice president integrated into the administration, and then the unthinkable happens? So my view is it should be required by law, or the vice president should at least have the legal authority to get intelligence briefings, to build a national security apparatus, to bring on advisors. Otherwise, you know, you can still legally have a situation where the vice president's only role is to have a heartbeat and to break a tie in the Senate.
Should we codify some of this stuff? Should we say this is what the vice – should we change the duties? Should we list them somehow, either by law or amendment of the Constitution?
I think it'll be very hard to get a constitutional amendment for this, but there's been various presidential succession laws throughout history. So the presidential succession law of 1792 says that the president pro tempore becomes the acting president if there's a vacancy in the presidency and the vice presidency. Then that law is upgraded in 1886 to remove the president pro tem and the speaker of the House from the line of succession and replace them with the cabinet. And then in 1947, the Speaker of the House and the President pro tem are reinstated in that reversed order. So we have a history of adapting and iterating on this with presidential succession laws, and I don't see why we couldn't do that for the vice president.
Given the loyalty that President Trump seems to require of anybody who works in close proximity with him or for him, is it safe to assume that Mike Pence is on the same page as President Trump should anything happen?
I think you can never assume that with vice presidents. At the end of the day, if I look at the history of the accidental presidents, not a single one of them has demonstrated loyalty towards the predecessor or the predecessor's agenda. Once they're president, you know, there's nobody above them, and they tend to want to chart their own course. What they might do is pander to the legacy of their predecessor, but context changes, situations change, they want to bring in their own advisors. And I think that even somebody like Mike Pence, who by all accounts has a close and trusting and loyal relationship with Donald Trump, I don't know why he wouldn't follow the same course that previous accidental presidents have followed.
Not all of these accidental presidents are terribly well known today, nor were their predecessors. How many of them do you believe were historically important, either for their accomplishments or their failures?
I mean, I think all of them are important because history was altered by the beat of a heart, right? So if you just go through them, you know, William Henry Harrison doesn't die. If William Henry Harrison doesn't die, you don't have the annexation of Texas in 1841, which guarantees war with Mexico and makes the Civil War inevitable. If Millard Fillmore doesn't ascend to the presidency after Taylor's death, you don't get the Compromise of 1850. If Andrew Johnson doesn't ascend to the presidency after Lincoln's death, then you don't get there's a chance that you don't get segregation. If Chester Arthur hadn't ascended to the presidency, James Garfield might have been able to put some of the segregationist agenda back in the box because he was a real civil rights advocate. Had Harding not died in office, the scandals might have broken and the Republican parties may have been unelectable and maybe you wouldn't have had the Great Depression. You know, with Truman, if Truman hadn't ascended to the presidency, you may not have gotten the same post-war order. And had LBJ not ascended to the presidency, I doubt you would have had the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
Wow.
It matters.
It does matter. And what you're saying, what I'm hearing you say, is that some of these people had far more impact than their elected predecessor.
Both positive and negative.
Mm. You say that we don't have to accept the current system in which running mates are chosen by the campaign, and that changing that system doesn't require a new law, just an alteration of party rules. But how would that happen?
So let's take the Democratic Party as an example. You have, you know, more than 20 people running for president of the United States. So they're basically interviewing for a job for the highest office in the land. With a field that diversified, why should we allow a candidate to have the sole decision-making authority about who would be their successor should the unthinkable happen? My view is if all these people are interviewing for a job and on display for the American people, that the party should wrestle the decision-making authority away from the nominee and make a decision and say the only people eligible to be on the ticket are people who run for the office in the first place. So at least we can get a sense of what they seem like as president and how they advertise themselves.
Because the last time we had a very large Republican field, this time we have a very large Democratic field. And by the time that race for the Republican nomination was over, and by the time inevitably the Democratic race will be over, there will be a lot of negative things said by one candidate to the other and about the other. And the winner will obviously have said a lot of negative things about his underlings who don't get the nomination. Why would they want to work together going forward? Why would Marco Rubio consider being Trump's vice president, given all the things that Donald Trump said about Marco Rubio back then?
Well, remember, the vice president can't be fired, right? And the party should care about balancing the ticket. Right now, if you have a presidential nominee making that selection, they're incentivized to pick somebody who's boring enough that they're not going to upstage them and not so boring that they're going to embarrass them. So you end up with these kind of very boring people who win a state or appease a constituency, as opposed to, you know, picking somebody who, you know, should the unthinkable happen, could be ready to lead the country.
You also suggest that political parties could establish vice presidential search committees, which would be comprised of different factions within the party. How would that be different from the old party boss system that selected the president in a smoke-filled room during the convention, as opposed to the primary system that we have today?
Well, so I think the primary system that we have today works for a presidential nominee, but you have the superdelegate phenomenon on the Democratic side. I think that makes much more sense for selecting a vice presidential candidate than it does selecting a presidential candidate, because you do want the party leadership to look at the person that they've nominated and figure out what's missing, and figure out, you know, is this the person who, you know, could lead, you know, should the president die in office or have to resign.
But politics sometimes creates strange choices and decisions, and sometimes ends up in a political hack being chosen to do a job because of various considerations. Do we really want a president saddled with a political hack as vice president?
Well, it's worked in two ways, right? So you can end up with a political hack as vice president, or you can end up with an overpowering figure. So if you look at the case of Teddy Roosevelt, the party bosses in New York were desperate to get rid of him. And so they thought they were sending him to his political death as vice president. And Mark Hanna, who was one of McKinley's top advisors, you know, after they won the election in 1900, says to McKinley, with Roosevelt as your vice president, you have one responsibility, which is to survive the next 4 years.
Did you come away, I have 10 seconds, did you come away with this optimistic after you did all this research?
I came away optimistic in the sense that if I look at our hysterical politics today, everything that we're seeing has some sort of root in some part of our history.
Jared Cohen, our guest, is the author of a fascinating book about American history, Accidental Presidents, Eight Men Who Changed America. Thank you for the hour.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.